Hello there, welcome to another episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen. In this episode, Ken and I want to focus on two recent judgments which are being hailed as significant contributions to the battle to defeat climate change, and which demonstrate, so environmental campaigners say, how litigation can play a vital role in holding governments to account in terms of their promise to achieve net zero. On 9th of April, the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights handed down judgment in a case brought against the Swiss government by a number of Swiss women over the age of 70, together with a non-profit association comprising some 2,000 women over the age of 70. The applicants complained of health problems, which they said worsen during heat waves and which particularly affect elderly women, and which impact their living and health conditions. Since 2016, they had made numerous unsuccessful requests to a number of authorities in Switzerland, alleging various omissions in relation to climate protection. They also requested the Swiss government that the necessary measures to meet the 2030 goals set by the 2015 Paris Agreement on Climate Change, COP21, in particular to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial levels. The women framed their claim as a failure to comply with a positive obligation to protect life under Article 2 of the Convention on Human Rights, as well as Article 8, respect for private and family life. They also complained under Article 6 of a violation of the right of access to a court to have the merits of their complaints considered. In a 16-1 majority decision, the Grand Chamber found the Swiss government liable for violations under Article 8 and Article 6. They said there was no need to examine the Article 2 claim. The one judge who dissented, powerfully, I think, was the British judge, Tim Eicher, King's Counsel, and we'll spend some time discussing his dissent with our guest. The other judgment we want to examine was handed down in the High Court in London last week by Mr. Justice Sheldon, brought by Friends of the Earth, Client Earth and the Good Law Project against the Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero. The judicial review judgment held that the government had breached its duty under the Climate Change Act 2008 to adopt policies and proposals to enable legally binding carbon reduction targets to be met. Counsel for the applicants in the Swiss case, as well as for Client Earth in last week's High Court judgment, was our good friend and Chambers colleague, Jessica Simor, King's Counsel. And we're very pleased to have her as our guest today to discuss the implications of those cases, and more generally the issue of whether litigation, whether before the European Court of Human Rights or domestic courts, can be effective in addressing the challenge presented by climate change. Jess, like Ken and me, is a founder member of Matrix Chambers. Called to the bar in 1992, she was made a silk in 2013, and she is an acclaimed specialist in public and regulatory law, EU law, competition law, and human rights law. She acts for a wide range of clients, ranging from companies, regulatory authorities, government departments, NGOs, and individuals. She is the original author and now consultant editor of the loose-leaf text Human Rights Practice. She's also the chair of the Bar European Group and a visiting professor at the LSE and Goldsmiths College. Jess, welcome to Double Jeopardy, and many thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hi, Tim. Hi, Ken. Nice to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us, Jess. I think it's fair to say that you've generated a very long, very long judgment in Strasbourg, but obviously also quite a monumental one.
Interestingly, it's 50 pages longer in French than in English.
Oh, well, that says a lot, doesn't it? That's very interesting. I wonder what that means.
Now, Jess, before we plunge into these issues, and they're quite complex, so we're going to have to try and simplify them. But before we do that, we always start with a few personal questions, background, childhood and all of that. Now, I think I'm right in saying you were born and brought up in North London. And so according to Suella Braverman and Liz Truss, you're a sort of fully paid up member of the tofu-eating North London liberal establishment. Is that right?
Actually, not quite. I actually emigrated to North London.
Oh, okay.
I'm more a South Londoner, but I became very much a not North Londoner, although I absolutely loathe toffee.
Good. That's a good start. And so just tell us how you got into law. When did you decide you wanted to be a lawyer? What was it that inspired you?
So I actually studied geography, but largely environmental sciences. And I wanted to do environmental work. I either wanted to go into forestry or agriculture. And I decided that that was not really feasible and decided to go into law, but from an environmental perspective. And at that time, the place really to do environmental work, or the only potential, was through EU law, where real policy was being made. Of course, it was the time of the Rio Earth Summit, the UNFCCC.
Well, so what are we talking about? How long ago was that?
I was at university 86 to 89.
Right. Okay.
And then I went into law around 1990. So I did go in to do environmental law, but it was very undeveloped. If you think that the Rio Summit was 92 and the UNFCCC was 1994. So it was very much the beginning. I went to Monckton Chambers, and then actually went to work in the Commission in the Environment Directorate.
Yeah.
So yes, I actually went into law to do environmental law, but it was just very undeveloped. And I went into an EU chambers on the basis that that was where policy was happening, and ended up doing a lot of competition law, state aid law. In fact, I was the trainee of Stephen Richards, who was Treasury Counsel then under John Major's dying government. And so I had a very interesting experience of sort of public law, and then went to Brussels, but really moved into EU competition, regulatory, etc.
So when did it become possible to focus more domestically on environmental law? When did that start to become a thing?
I think environmental law initially was concerned with things like product labelling, chemicals. I did a lot of that kind of work through EU directives. But then I did do pollution control project in Brussels. So I'm not saying that one couldn't focus on it, but litigation has only really arisen in the bigger sphere relatively recently.
As well as your legal practice, you're also well known via social media because you have a Twitter account, X account, which has almost 205,000 followers, which for a lawyer is enormous. And I was just looking through your feed today. You were tweeting today about the disgraceful decision to admit Natalie Elphick to the Labour Party, and you've tweeted a lot about the current war in Gaza and a number of other issues. Before we get on to the environmental cases, as I said, I wanted to just ask you what your reaction was when last year Alex Chalk, the Justice Secretary, famously attacked lefty lawyers for, as he put it on the Today programme, is the strong tradition of lawyers in this country is that you simply act for your client without fear or favour. You don't necessarily associate yourself with that cause. And then says there's a regrettable tendency in the last 10 years for lawyers to actively parade their politics and to identify more with their clients. Now, leaving aside the irony of the political Secretary of State for Justice complaining about people being political, what did you think about that? And did you think he was attacking people like you?
Just to be fair to him, he's not complaining about people being political. He's complaining about lawyers who are involved in cases being political about those cases, which is a bit different from being Secretary of State for Justice, surely.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe. Anyway, what did you think?
Well, I do not tweet about my cases. And in fact, it is suggested to me, perhaps, that I should use my Twitter platform rather more to promote my career than to state my views on things. And I just don't use it for that purpose. And I'm very careful not to do so. And I'm a strong believer in the cab rank rule. I act for government. I always have. I was on all the Treasury panels and I continue to act for government. So I rather agree with Alex Chalk in the sense that I actually don't think it's very good to identify so strongly with your clients. Now, when it comes to something like climate change, it is rather different because, in a sense, you cannot be against mitigating climate change unless you are a wholly irrational person. And so I think it's a rather different position. I have to say, I rather fell into Twitter. It was a bit of an accident. I was completely anonymous on Twitter and I had an anonymous account, and I much preferred it that way. I'm quite a private person. But then Brexit happened. And Brexit changed things for me. And
yeah.
I wrote an article and actually put my account publicly on Twitter in order to get that article out, because it was about the revocation of an Article 50 notification. And it got a huge amount of following, you know, which kind of multiplied. And I think that's why I have so many followers. So initially I went onto Twitter simply to correct the inaccuracies in relation to EU law. So I stayed very kind of strict, and then slowly I just kind of got sucked in. So, I mean, it's a bit of an accident. It wasn't something I did on purpose.
It happens to lots of us.
And you became very politically active, in fact. I think you became very well known during the great debates over Brexit, particularly after the vote. And am I right? Did you stand as a candidate for the Independent Group in the post-Brexit election?
I did. I stood agreeing to stand as sort of number 8 on the list, knowing that I could not be elected as number 8 on the list. Again, as a sort of platform, I suppose, to get the information out, because that was still at a time when we could have had a second referendum and Brexit could have been stopped.
You were a strong supporter of a second referendum, like Keir Starmer, I should say.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea that we left the EU in the way we did is just extraordinary, really. It's an absolutely extraordinary way of going about public affairs.
That's about 15 programmes, obviously, which we won't be addressing today. So let's just move next to try and break down these two cases. I've given a sort of short introduction to them. Now, let's take the European Court of Human Rights case, first of all, which is, for those who wish to look it up, it's Verein Klima Seniorinnen Schweiz and others against Switzerland.
Tim, I think you're putting on a bit of a comedy German accent there.
Sorry about that. Anyway, that, and that's...
Swiss Deutsch. Yeah.
Jess, why don't you pronounce it?
It's Swiss Deutsch.
Very good.
Pretty much like me, actually. Yeah. Anyway, that's the name of the association, which, as I say, was comprised of about 2,000 women in their 70s or older than that, who brought this complaint. Now, the case raises a wide range of interesting issues under the convention system itself, and indeed the whole basis on which locus standi or victim status was accepted was heavily criticised in the dissenting judgment, as well as the basis on which Article 8 was found to be applicable to address climate change. But can we just start by you summarising how the case was being presented and what the majority of 16 judges held?
So, as you've said, Tim, there were four named applicants and then an association that represented over 2,000 women of aged more than 70. And the essential thrust of the case was that elderly women are more severely affected by heat because their bodies are less able to regulate temperature. And this causes a heightened risk of organ failure and other illnesses. And for that reason, they would have standing in the Swiss courts. Now, it's important to understand why these women brought the case. It was because in Switzerland, there is a very odd rule of standing, which is that you have to show that you're more affected than another group. So it's not if everybody's affected, no one has standing effectively. So that is why it was this group that brought the claim.
But why couldn't they win in Switzerland? Why couldn't they say we as a group of women in their 70s or older are particularly affected by climate change?
Well, they could have, except that the Swiss courts dismissed the case for various reasons, including causation, when harm would occur, etc.
And so that's why they won the Article 6 claim. In other words, they didn't get access to the court in Switzerland.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is this the so-called actio popularis principle?
Well, not. I mean, it's very odd because obviously all European countries have different standing rules for public law claims. And I was very surprised to hear that in Switzerland, one of the requirements is that you can actually show that you are more significantly affected than some other category.
And isn't there some sort of prohibition on bringing a case in the public good or for the public good? You have to show some sort of individual benefit.
Well, there is in Strasbourg.
In Strasbourg, okay.
There is in Strasbourg, and there may well be also in Switzerland.
Yeah, the general rule, actio popularis, is effectively the international law term for class actions. So that's not the problem in the domestic courts. But yes, anyway, carry on, Jess.
So before Strasbourg, they argued that the failure of Switzerland to adopt legislative measures to ensure the reduction of emissions from Switzerland was a failure of Switzerland to discharge its positive obligation to protect them from their risk to their lives and well-being under Articles 8 and Articles 2, and that they had been deprived of access to court under Article 6. And I think what was central to this case, obviously there were several important factors in this case. One was the fact that Switzerland has actually failed to adopt legislative measures and has also failed to implement legislative measures that it had adopted. So it hasn't got measures equivalent to what we have in the UK, which require the reduction of emissions along a pathway, etc.
So that's very significant, isn't it?
Very significant. And I think we made a very central part of our both observations and speech were the specific facts in relation to the position in Switzerland. And those are set out in detail from 558 onwards in the judgment. So that was very important, I believe.
Was there not also this curious fact, which was that the Swiss Parliament had passed legislation, but then it had been overturned at a referendum? Is that correct?
That's right. They'd passed some legislation and it had been rejected, the actual means of achieving whatever had been rejected in referendum. And that was one of the main defences brought by Switzerland, or argued by Switzerland. It was that, well, you know, there was nothing we can do because the people have said no. But of course, you could always say that. That just happens to be their democratic system, that things go through referendums.
But why wasn't that a good argument, Jess? If, I mean, in a democracy, if the people say, no, we don't want these measures, that does raise an issue as to whether a court should be saying, nevertheless, you must impose them, doesn't it?
Well, it's the same in every state, effectively, that, you know, our parliament can say no to something and Strasbourg says, well, that's a violation of the convention.
Yeah, perhaps we can address Ken's point in the context of the dissent by Judge Eicher, because he raises that point. And so the culmination then was that the failure of Switzerland to enact appropriate legislation to meet carbon emissions and the particular position of the association. I mean, there was a strange aspect to it, wasn't it? The individual women applicants failed to be admissible because they hadn't established the necessary threshold of actual imminent risk to themselves, but the association was recognised as having victim status and therefore was able to bring the claim before the Strasbourg court. That's right, isn't it, Jess?
Yeah, and this is actually, I think, perhaps the most important finding in the judgment, or it has huge consequences for environmental litigation, because there is always a difficulty in environmental litigation in showing direct and individual personal harm, or there often is. So the court has done something quite revolutionary here. It has said that the ban on actus popularis, so actions on behalf of the public in general, in Article 34 of the Convention, doesn't preclude associations that represent individuals' human rights in relation to the environment bringing claims before Strasbourg. And that does not require the association to show that any of those individuals are directly and personally affected, as they would have to be if they were individual applicants.
So this is a way to get round that rule, essentially.
Yeah, and it is a change.
Yeah.
It's a fundamental development. They've tried to restrict it. They've set down a test, a sort of three-stage test. But nonetheless, it is a big change in Strasbourg.
They justify this because of the overwhelming importance of the climate issue and its impact on everybody.
Yes, and the difficulty of being able to litigate climate change. So, I mean, that is criticised by Judge Eicher, but it's very important, and I would say it's a huge development for environmental law. And it's reflective also of the Aarhus Convention, and it's a development that has been a long time coming, if you like.
I mean, it's difficult to see how you could pursue environmental law at that high level without a change in that rule.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you. So that covers, in brief, what the Strasbourg case has decided. As I say, we'll come on in a minute to look at the implications, the broader implications, both for the Strasbourg system as well as the climate change issues, how that judgment will impact on other member states of the convention system. But the other case that I mentioned was the one handed down last week, and that's a domestic law case, as I say, brought by Friends of the Earth and Client Earth, and you acted for Client Earth. Can you just summarise again for us the background to that case and what the judge decided?
Well, this is really quite an extraordinary case because it's the second case in which Client Earth, Friends of the Earth, challenged the government's plan or policy to meet the carbon budgets. In the UK, we have the Climate Change Act, which is a leading piece of legislation that requires the government to lay down budgets every 5 years for carbon emission reductions, i.e. you can't exceed that level of emissions during that five-year period. And when that budget is published, or soon after, the Secretary of State is required to publish the plans and policies that will enable that budget to meet. So Section 13 of the Act requires the Secretary of State to publish his plans and policies that, in the words of the legislation, will enable the carbon budget to be met. Now, he published his plan for the sixth budget in 2021, the net zero plan, and that was challenged on the basis that it hadn't involved any risk assessment in relation to those plans. And that challenge was successful in front of Mr. Justice Holgate, and the Secretary of State had to go away and produce another report, a Section 13 report, which he did. And we challenged that report on the basis that there may have been a risk assessment, but the conclusion that those plans and policies could rationally meet that budget was itself irrational or unlawful. And on disclosure, we discovered that at least at around 60% of the emissions reductions that had been planned were on the basis of high risk or uncertain policies. So somehow the Secretary of State had satisfied himself, now herself, that the budget could be met or will be met despite around 50 to 60% of the plans and policies being high risk or uncertain. And Mr. Justice Sheldon accepted that the Secretary of State had effectively not properly quantified risk because the quantification of risk had not been applied to the actual emission reduction budgets, and so has again held that this report is also unlawful in breach of Section 13 obligation.
And one of the important bits of evidence that you and Friends of the Earth relied upon was a witness statement from Lord Deben, that used to be John Selwyn Gummer when he was an MP, and he had been the chair of the Climate Change Committee, which is the body set up by the 2008 Act and which is intended to be an important part of the entire scheme for monitoring and assisting in carbon reduction research and planning. And one of the things that he said is that before the carbon budget delivery plan, the latest one which you were challenging, before it was produced in March 2023, the government had not provided information to the Climate Change Committee in advance. And he says in this witness statement where he basically rings the Minister of State the night before it's to be published and tells him, listen, mate, I haven't received a copy of this report. And the minister said, oh, I didn't realise that you hadn't been provided with this report. And they said it would be corrected, but they don't get it until 7 o'clock on the night before publication. And what Lord Deben says in his witness statement is it was difficult to avoid the view that the government did not want us to examine the plan carefully before they published it. What was going on there?
I don't know what was going on sort of behind the scenes, but it's quite obvious that the position has worsened in terms of, you know, the intention and aspiration to actually meet these statutory obligations. And you may have heard that Chris Skidmore, even just a couple of days ago, himself, having been a minister for state and having resigned with a by-election, actually stated at the Climate Impact Summit that the Conservative Party is endangering people's lives, people's jobs, and the opportunities for communities to grow, and is now rowing back on energy transition. So it seems to be politics.
It's definitely politics. And then they just didn't want Deben's comments when they published this stuff. The same thing happened to me when I was overseeing a review of counterterrorism powers in 2011, and I was supposed to publish a report alongside the results of the review, and I got a phone call saying the review is going to be published tomorrow, giving me little or no opportunity to add my bit. And I remember talking to you about this at the time, Tim. That was pure politics. It's just politics. They don't want a contrary view because that might grab the attention of journalists rather than the report itself. So it's, you're right. Obviously, Jess, it's purely political.
But what we did have here was we had two complex and detailed reports by the Climate Change Committee that had examined both the net zero report and the carbon budget delivery plan, so the 2021 and 2023 plans. Therefore, we had a non-governmental but connected and under the department statutory body that had reported on these plans and had found them significantly wanting. We didn't need to rely on our own evidence. We had evidence from the government department itself.
Shall we come on to the ICA dissent in the Strasbourg case, which is obviously significant? I mean, he was one dissenting judge, but it got quite a lot of attention politically because he was saying something that some politicians wanted to hear, which, and I'm obviously not suggesting that he said it for that reason. He's a fantastic judge who I'm sure we've all got great respect for, but he was certainly saying something that politicians of a particular stripe found attractive, which is to say, this is judicial overreach, these are political matters, these are matters for national parliaments, and judges are becoming too activist. I mean, essentially, that's what he was saying about this judgment, wasn't it? That it went too far.
As I said in the introduction, I found his dissent actually very, very powerful and persuasive, because it was certainly not a dissent coming from someone who's critical of the convention system or is some sort of mad Brexiteer at all. I mean, Tim Eich happens to be of German origin, but he obviously practiced here in Britain before becoming the British judge. He's not coming at it from that at all. And he says in paragraph 5, having set out his profound, and it really is very profound, concern about this judgment, both in terms of the creation, as he says, of a completely new Article 8 right to protect people from climate change. He also very concerned about the standing decision and the implications of that, which you, Jess, have said you regard as almost the most important aspect of the case. But before you answer this, Jess, and give your views on what he said, let me just read what he says in paragraph 5. He says, "It's worth repeating that my disagreement with the majority does not relate in any way to the nature or magnitude of the risks and the challenges posed by anthropogenic or human-created climate change. I completely share their understanding of the urgent need to address this issue, both on its own and perhaps as importantly as a major aspect of the Reykjavik Declaration." And he says, "My principal disagreement with the majority solely relates to the role this court can play at this point in time in identifying and taking the steps necessary and frequently already overdue to ensure the survival of our planet." And in his final paragraph, he says something really quite strong, in which he effectively says he's concerned that, consequently, while I understand and share the very real sense of a need for urgency in relation to the fight against anthropogenic climate change, I fear that in this judgment, the majority has gone beyond what it is legitimate and permissible for this court to do, and unfortunately, in doing so, may well have achieved exactly the opposite effect to what was intended. So it's a pretty strong language, isn't it? What was your assessment of that dissent?
So I agree with you that it is persuasive. This case was not an easy case. And in that sense, as a, you know, litigator, it was an extraordinary victory. It is a persuasive dissent, and I wouldn't go against that. I think it's interesting, the bit you read out from paragraph 5, it sort of discloses the different attitude to the role of the judge, because you read out the last bit, "My principal disagreement with the majority, therefore, solely relates to the role this court can play at this point in time in identifying and taking the steps, frequently already overdue, to ensure the survival of our planet." Now, if you are a human rights court and you are faced with the question of whether you can do something to ensure the survival of our planet in relation to something that is well overdue, in his own words, I suppose many, and the majority in this case, felt that it was absolutely necessary to do something and that it could do that within the court's jurisprudence. And one factor I didn't mention that I think was very important in our success in this case was the fact that the Dutch Supreme Court, which is required to follow Strasbourg jurisprudence, had already found that Article 8 imposed this obligation. So had the Strasbourg court gone against us in this case, it would have effectively required the Supreme Court in Holland to overturn its judgment. And therefore, its decision would have been regressive rather than actually status quo or progressive. So I understand what he's saying, but I also understand why a human rights court would say we have to do something. And in light of the Paris Agreement commitments of the states, we can do something.
So this calls into question again the question of courts versus national parliaments. Interestingly, one of the things that Dijker says is paradoxically this decision might distract national parliaments from what's necessary. But I just want to broaden this out a bit. There was a very interesting article in this week's New Statesman written by Professor John Gray, the highly distinguished philosopher and commentator, a school professor of European thought emeritus at the London School of Economics. And he's writing about this issue of courts versus national parliaments. And he says, amongst other things, "The most effective defence against tyranny is not an ever multiplying panoply of rights, which activist judges interpret in accordance with the ruling ideology, but a functioning democracy." Sorry, I'm just going to carry on because I think this is interesting and pertinent. "The fundamental threat to freedom in the West comes not from Marxism, postmodernism, or even the increasing sway of autocratic regimes in boardrooms and universities, but from within liberalism. Far from being an empirical philosophy open in principle to learning from experience, it has become a self-referential worldview that screens out forbidden truths. With the closing of the liberal mind, critical thinking, in inverted commas, has become the recitation of a secular catechism, an exercise designed to banish other modes of thought. At bottom, the liberal assault on free speech is a bid for unchecked power. By shifting the locus of decision from democratic deliberation to legal procedures, progressives aim to insulate their cultish programs from contestation and accountability. And I think this is an important sentence. The politicization of law and the hollowing out of politics go hand in hand. And then he goes on to say the high point of this strategy may have been the ruling in your case. So he's making very forcefully and eloquently the argument here that what's going on in judicial activism is in essence the hollowing out of politics and the divorce of politics from people's views out there in the real world. And this is essentially destructive and potentially tyrannical.
Well, I think it's absolute nonsense. I mean, it's fine words. And John Gray has done many such, he's written many such articles and done various Radio 4 sort of lectures and along those lines. But actually, what is needed, certainly in relation to climate change, what is needed is action. And, you know, democracy beset with the effects of climate change are going to be what will destroy democracy. When we have vast, vast emigration, millions of people in areas that can no longer support them moving, we are going to have war, famine. That is the end of democracy. Climate change has to be addressed.
But Jess, the end of democracy may come before that if people feel that their national parliaments are no longer able to enact laws that they wish to see enacted. I mean, we might see the end of democracy a little sooner than through the baleful effects of climate change if we're not careful.
Well, I mean, we could have a long discussion about populism. I do not ascribe to those views. I ascribe to the views that governments have a responsibility to their people to do what is necessary for their well-being. And I also ascribe to the international order, which is essential if we're going to address these kind of challenges.
Let's leave John Gray's point perhaps to one side and go back to what Tim Eicher, Judge Eicher, said as the basis for his dissent. And again, I'm looking at paragraph 65. His criticism, his fundamental criticism here in relation to the finding that Article 8 applies and is violated. He said the concern is that the majority have created a new right for individuals to effective protection by the state authorities from serious adverse effects on their life, health, well-being and quality of life arising from the harmful effects and risks caused by climate change, and imposed a new primary duty on contracting parties to adopt and to effectively apply in practice regulations and measures capable of mitigating the existing and potentially irreversible future effects of climate change. And he says that's an obligation which the majority translate into a requirement. Each contracting state undertake measures for the substantial and progressive reduction of their respective greenhouse gas emission levels with a view to reaching net neutrality within the next 3 decades. And then he makes this point, and this is really the thing I want you to perhaps respond to. He makes the point that neither of this right or this duty has any basis in Article 8 or any other provision or protocol to the convention. And indeed, the European movement has rejected adopting such a protocol to create the right. And so I suppose his concern is that this judgment, in its overreach, which is effectively what he's saying, is likely to undermine the court system because it will confirm all the prejudices of, you know, the Suella Braverman and Liz Truss and all of the far right of the Tory party who want to withdraw from the convention system, precisely because the feeling is that the court, particularly through Article 8, is committing regular judicial overreach, and in this case in a spectacular way. So what do you say about that?
And we can't confine criticism of this approach to Suella Braverman and the usual suspects. There is very respectable and broad view, including an academic view, that this sort of judicial activism is dangerous. And the Judge Eicher is pointing that out. And there's an argument that what's happening here is that the court is just in a very fundamental way inventing law, which is antithetical to parliamentary process.
Well, let me address that on the basis of 2 points. First, the substance, whether they are actually creating a new right. As I said, the Dutch Supreme Court found on the basis of Strasbourg jurisprudence that this right existed under Article 8. And certainly Judge Eicher is not right to say that Article 8 and Article 2 do not already, or did not prior to this judgment, already provide an obligation on the state to protect individuals within their jurisdiction from serious adverse effects on their life, health and well-being. It's just that no case had come forward in relation to climate change. This happened to be the first one. So
yeah, but hang on a sec, Jess. But it's not up to the Dutch Supreme Court to wag the dog, is it?
No, I'm not saying that it is. What I'm saying is that it is wrong to say that Article 8 and Article 2 did not already provide the case law of the court for that obligation on the state to protect against serious adverse effects on health. I mean, we know that from the many cases in relation to pollution and waste tips and all the rest of it. It's just that it extended it here to climate change, which I accept involved various difficulties in relation to causation, etc. And the second point concerns the way that Judge Eicher put his judgment. As I said, his judgment is persuasive. I didn't understand why he chose, however, to actually use explicit language. For example, in paragraph 2, he explicitly says the disagreement is of a fundamental nature. It goes to the very heart of the role of the court in the convention system. And he challenges the use of evolutive interpretation. So he's very explicit in a way that I felt was actually political. So his comments, including the one, Tim, that you read at the end of the judgment, gave his judgment a political spin that he could have avoided had he not used that language. He could simply have set out his legal view of the case without talking about the convention system. And I found that very surprising and unnecessary.
Well, it may be that you're right there, that he was using what you call political language precisely because of an awareness that the court system is under a fundamental attack, not just in the UK from, for example, currently the far right of the Tory party, but in other countries too. And so it's perhaps a cri de coeur.
And I'm sure he understands, as all the judges should, that sometimes the court needs political defending. It needs defending by politicians, and sometimes they have to have the ammunition to do that if we're not to see the whole system undermined.
That's right, but I felt he gave ammunition to those who would wish to undermine the court with his language. And I found that surprising.
Certainly plenty of people in that category enjoyed what he said.
Jess, again, I mean, taking on board your point that what he said and the way he said it undoubtedly provides succour to critics of the court system as a whole. But his central point, and it's perhaps set out in paragraph 69, he says, I also do worry that in having taken the approach and come to the conclusion they have, the majority are in effect giving false hope that litigation and courts can provide the answer without there being, in effect, any prospect of litigation, especially before this court, accelerating the taking of the necessary measures towards the fight against anthropogenic climate change. And then he goes on to say, in fact, he thinks there's a risk that the new right or obligation created by the majority judgment will be an unwelcome, unnecessary distraction for national and international authorities, both executive and legislative, in that it detracts attention from the ongoing legislative and negotiating efforts being undertaken as we speak. So, I mean, he was concerned.
Well, that's his personal view.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that that's got anything to do with law. He may or may not be right. He probably isn't right, actually, because the more energy that is put into, or more pressure that is put into demanding action from national governments, the better. The fact that litigants might actually be disappointed doesn't really matter. What matters is that action is taken. And I just want to add one point, which I meant to say in relation to the substance, and that is that all of this is underpinned by the fact that nations, all of the 195 states, have made specific commitments under the Paris Agreement. And the bit, Tim, that you read out from Judge Eicher, it's actually a commitment that states have already made under the Paris Agreement. So the court was not sort of plucking this out of nowhere. The court was saying that there is effectively an international consensus and that that international law obligation, or rather Article 8, has to be read in the light of that international law obligation that all of those states had accepted. And so we have to remember in this that Switzerland was not at any point denying its obligation to take the most ambitious measures as required by Article 2 and 4 of the Paris Agreement. Switzerland accepted it had that obligation. The question was whether the failure to meet that obligation constituted a breach of Article 8. And I think that is also central to the judgment.
Yeah, that's obviously very important context, and one can see how that was a powerful argument on your side. Anyway, this was obviously, whatever anyone thinks of the judgment, obviously a great forensic triumph, Jess, and actually a historic triumph, because it's going to, I think, have all sorts of repercussions, both legal repercussions and perhaps in a less constructive way, some political repercussions. But congratulations on the result, on both results, and thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks very much, Jess.
Thank you. Pleasure. It was nice to see you.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with Tim Owen and me, Ken MacDonald. If you've enjoyed this conversation as much as we have with Jess Simore today, then do listen to some of our back catalogue. We have episodes with Brenda Hale, the former President of the Supreme Court, the Secretary of State for Justice, Alex Chalk, the Director of the Serious Fraud Office, Nick F. Grave, Professor Kathleen Stock, the leading lawyer, David Panic, Lord Panic, and many, many others. And we hope that you'll enjoy browsing through some of those if you haven't already listened to them. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you again very soon.